Hello and welcome to Russian Bookshelf, a weekly podcast on the subject of good books from or about Russia. My name is Ian Mitchell, and each week I will be inviting a guest to tell us about his or her favourite book connected with this large, controversial, but always highly literate country. All books selected will be available in English, and we will end each podcast with a brief reading from the one our guest has chosen. Today my guest is Ludmila Ulitskaya, the author of many best-selling post-Soviet novels, most recently Daniel Stein, Interpreter. We will discuss that in due course, and I will read a sample of the text from the beginning, which is what the author requested as the most appropriate introductory extract. But first I'd like to mention where Ludmila lives. I met her in a large, unmodernized flat full of paintings and sketches done by her husband, a professional artist. That's unusual in today's Russia, where most large flats are post-Soviet. Ludmila's flat is in a complex of buildings which is erected for use by members of the Writers' Union. Most people have heard about Peredelkino, the writer's village to the southwest of Moscow, where Boris Pasternak lived while he was writing Dr. Zhivago. Fewer know about the two urban settlements, one being built in the 1930s near the Tretyakov Gallery, and the other one, where Ludmila lives, near Aeroport metro station in the 1970s.
The Soviet writers were very much like to the Soviet officials. And it doesn't mean there was no talented or capable people among them, but they were all the members of Writers' Union, and they were completely controlled by the governments, and they received privilege for good behavior. And one of these privileges was the flat. It was the period when it's very hard to get housing, and it was really privilege. And now the most part of these writers are dead, and partly this flat was sold, partly continue with their relatives. And I am belonging to the last category, because I was not a writer in the Soviet period. I was wife of son of Soviet writer. And my getting for this flat is not my merits. It's only for my relatives.
Ludmila started her career as a geneticist, but she was expelled from her institute for reading banned books. An example she gave me was G.K. Chesterton, but her reading did go a lot more widely than that. However, it is perhaps symbolic of the contradictions of the position of literature in the Soviet Union that she lived in a house for writers and lost a job because she did too much reading.
Another problem, the problem of Soviet writers. The father of my husband was a very small writer, but his biography was very interesting because he had good education. He was a very educated man. But the feeling of fear, he was full of fear. And he was one of the decent Soviet writers. And his enormous flat was done him for his good behavior.
After being expelled from the Genetics Institute, Ludmila went into the theater. Then she started writing plays, screenplays, and eventually short stories. Finally, a collection of her work was published in France in 1993, even though she was still completely unknown in Russia. To date, she has published about 20 books, more successfully so in Germany and France than in the English-speaking world, but now very successfully in Russia too. They have been translated into 32 languages. Daniel Stein, which has already sold 500,000 copies in Russia, was published this summer in the United States and soon after in Great Britain. It has sold well, but not spectacularly, which is a shame as it tells a remarkable story in fictional form of a figure whom Ludmila once met. This is how she described it to me.
It was inspired by my meeting a Catholic monk, a man with an absolutely incredible life story, starting with his experience surviving in the World War. And one day he has spent in Moscow, he spent in my house. He was on his way from Haifa, where he lived there, to Belarus, for meeting with the people he helped to escape from the ghetto on 42nd year, 50 years after escape of these people. And the rest of these people, for white people and their children, have meeting in Belarus, in this small town where it happened. and he told me his story. It was absolutely grandiose day in my life, because I feel that it's apostle or saint people. He looked very ordinary, very poor clothes, small and modest man. But his story shocked me absolutely.
The story, very briefly, was of a Polish Jewish boy who witnessed Nazi executions in a small town in what is now Belarusia. He helped many escape and finally escaped himself. After the war, he converted to Christianity since, as Ludmila explained to me, he thought that the only answer to barbarity of the sort he had witnessed was the principle of reconciliation and forgiveness. He became a priest and later was admitted to a Carmelite monastery in Poland, in competition for the only other available place at the time with a young artist called Karol Wojtyla, who later went on to greater things under a different and less Polish name. Many years later, Ludmila's hero emigrated to Israel, where he spent the rest of his life working for reconciliation between both Jews and Christians and Jews and Muslims. Seeing this latter one as a religious problem rather than a racial one, he preferred to live among the Arab Christians, who must be one of the most disadvantaged people on earth as a result of the problems and prejudices Ludmila's character was trying to address. The story of Daniel Stein is a fictionalized version of the true story of Oswald Rufeisen and is told by one of the people whom he saved and who now lives in the United States.
The history of one of the women who was born in ghetto. It's a real personage, it's my friend. She was connected with Daniel and he helped her to survive. I think it's about 100 heroes in this book. It's very, very crowded book, but it's very, very close to reality. The story of a woman who lived now, really lived now in Boston.
In character, this person's name is Eva Manukyan. This is the way she introduces herself. Part 1, December 1985, Boston. I always feel cold. Even in summer at the beach, with the sun blazing down, there is a coldness in my spine. I guess it's because I was born in winter, in a forest, and spent the first months of my life in a sleeve of my mother's winter coat. I was not expected to live, so if life is a gift for anyone, it truly is for me. I'm just not entirely sure it's a present I really wanted. Some people's memory of themselves switches on very early. Mine starts with the Catholic orphanage when I was 2. I always really wanted to find out what happened to me and to my parents during the years I don't remember at all. I learned a few things from my elder brother Vitek, but he was too little then, and the memories he passed down to me don't really fill in the picture. When he was in the hospital, he filled up half a school exercise book and told me everything he could remember. We didn't know at the time that our mother was still alive. He died of sepsis when he was 16, before she came back from the labor camps. My identity documents give my place of birth as Emsk, but in fact that is only where I was conceived. My mother fled from the Emsk ghetto in August 1942 when she was 6 months pregnant and took with her my six-year-old brother Vitek. I was actually born about 100 kilometers from Emsk, in impenetrable forest, in a secret colony of Jews who'd escaped the ghetto and hid there right until Belarusia was liberated in August 1944. It was a partisan unit, although in reality it was just 300 Jews trying to survive in an area occupied by the Germans. I imagine the men were more concerned to use their weapons to protect this dugout of women, old people and the few children who survived than to fight the Germans. Many years later, my mother told me my father stayed in the ghetto and died there. A few days after my mother's escape, all the people still there were shot. She told me he refused to leave. He believed an attempt to escape would only anger the Germans and bring forward the showdown, so my pregnant mother took Vitek and left without him. Of the 800 people in the ghetto, only 300 decided to escape. The Germans had herded Jews from Emsk and the surrounding villages into the ghetto. My mother was not a local woman, but she was there for a reason. She was a fanatical communist and had been sent from Lvov as an agent. She had given birth to Vitek in a Lvov prison in 1936. The father was a party comrade. My own father was someone she met in the ghetto. I have never in my life met a woman less suited to motherhood than my mother. I'm quite sure my brother and I were born solely because of a lack of prophylactics and abortion facilities. When I was young, I hated her. Then for many years I viewed her with alienated amazement. To this day, I can scarcely bear to be with her. Thank God I see her very rarely. Anytime I ask her about the past, she bristles and starts yelling at me. To her, I have always been an apolitical bourgeoise. She is absolutely right about that. But I've had a baby myself, and I know for a fact that when a child comes into the world, a woman's life, to a greater or lesser extent, is subordinated to that fact. Not in her case, though. She is a maniacal Communist Party member. A month ago, I made the acquaintance of Esther Guntman. She's a charming, transparent old lady, very white, and with a blue-rinsed head of grey hair. She's a friend of Karin. They worked together for some charity, and Karin had been telling me about her for a long time, but I took no interest. Shortly before Christmas, Karin arranged a party for her 50th birthday, and I immediately noticed Esther. She just somehow stood out among all those people I half knew. The party was far more heartfelt and sincere than is usual in America. There were a lot of Poles, a few Russians, and a couple of Yugoslavs. The Slavic presence made itself pleasantly felt at this American celebration, and you heard snatches of Polish conversation. I speak Russian and Polish fluently, but I have a Polish accent when I speak English. Esther noticed that when we exchanged a few words. "You're from Poland?" she asked. I always have trouble with that question. It's difficult to give a quick reply, and you can hardly embark on a long explanation that my mother was born in Warsaw and I was born in Bielorussia, don't know who my father was, spent my childhood in Russia, and went to Poland only in 1954, and went back to Russia to study, moved from there to the GDR, and then on to America. This time, however, I said something I never normally say. I was born in Emsk, more precisely in Czarnopuszcza. The old lady gasped and then asked, "When were you born?" I told her, "In 1942. I never tried to conceal my age, because I know I look young. People never guess I'm 43. She gave me a little hug, and the blue rinse wobbled as her old head trembled. "My God, my God! So you did survive. That mad woman gave birth to you in a dugout, and my husband delivered you. And then within a month, I suppose, she took you children and went off to who knows where. Everybody urged her to stay, but she wouldn't listen. Everybody was sure she'd be caught on the road or in the first village you came to. Glory be, you survived." We went out into the hallway and just couldn't be separated. When we took our coats off the hangers, it was so funny. They were both the same, heavy fox fur, which is almost improper in America. I found out later that Esther suffered from the cold too. We drove to her house. She lives in the centre of Boston, on Commonwealth Avenue, a marvellous district just 10 minutes away from me. As we were driving, I had such a strange feeling. All my life I have longed for someone older and wiser, someone who could guide me and whom I could obey and joyfully do what they told me to. I always felt the lack of that. In the orphanage, of course, the discipline was strict, but it was quite a different matter. All through my life I have played the role of the senior person. My mother, my husbands, my friends, none of them were ever really grown up. There was just something about this little old lady that made me want to agree in advance with everything she said. We went into her house and she turned on the lights. The bookcases started in the hallway and went all the way back to the depths of the apartment. She saw me looking at them. "This is my late husband's library. He could read 5 languages and there are masses of books about art. I need to find a good home to leave all this to." I remember Karin had told me that Esther was a widow with no children, quite rich but very lonely. Almost all of her family were killed during the war. I gazed at Esther like a child mesmerised by a chocolate. She would have been the perfect mother, aunt or grandmother, calm and gentle, elegant in a European way with a silk blouse and Italian shoes, but without ostentation or that naive American chic. She even called me my dear child. Esther and her husband were themselves Polish Jews, both medically qualified, and had moved to those parts a few years before the war. Isaac was a surgeon and Esther a dentist. She had graduated from dental school in Frankfurt. They were not free thinkers, just ordinary Jews who would light the Sabbath candles but might just as easily go out in the Sabbath to a concert in the next town. The local Jews considered them outsiders, but still went to them for dental treatment. When Germany annexed Poland, Isaac immediately told his wife it was the end of everything, and they needed to get out and go wherever they could. He even thought of Palestine. But while they were thinking what was the best and practical thing to do, they found themselves under German occupation in the ghetto. Later on, when Esther looked very wearied and it was late, we agreed to meet again and I left. I have a strange feeling. I have always wanted to know about that time and about my father, but now I'm suddenly afraid. I want equally strongly to know and not to know, because for so long I dragged my past around, and it is only in the last few years with Grisha that it has fallen away from me. Eva, that little girl from the Polish children's home in Zagorsk, and the teenager from a Soviet orphanage seem no longer to be me, just stills from a film I saw long ago. Now I have an opportunity of finding out how everything actually happened. I still cannot imagine what would make a young woman, a mother with two children, hand them over to a children's home. It still seems to me there must be something there that I do not know. Daniel Stein, Interpreter, by Ludmila Ulitskaya, is published by the Overlook Press in the United States and by Duckworth's in Great Britain. That's all we have time for now. I hope you will join us next week for another edition of Russian Bookshelf, a podcast from the publishers of Russia Beyond the Headlines. Thank you for listening. Goodbye.